CMU podcast in association with 7Digital.
This week, happy birthday, The Charts, Deezer and Ryan Adams. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. I have with me Chris Cook, who is business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris. Say hello quickly.
I just took my glasses off.
Shush! We don't have time for chit-chat this week.
I'm putting them back on so I can see you. Because if I can't see you, it's going to be a disaster from beginning to end.
This is already a disaster. We haven't got time because we've got a very tight record time this week and someone was late.
Well, I was speaking at an event.
I'm glad you took the blame in because I was also late.
Well, I didn't know that. If you hadn't said that, then I would have thought that you'd been sitting here since the start of our recording time. So
right.
This is going to be a super speedy edition of See Me Podcast, which actually, although that's a sort of a result of circumstance, some of our listeners might be going, yay! A much quicker, speedier, more concise See Me Podcast. So let's see how it goes.
Yes. Are you ready? Because that was quite a lot of waffle.
I'm ready.
Let's go. Happy birthday. What's happened?
It's not my birthday.
Shush.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm going to stop that. I think people might find that quite stressful if I keep shouting at you. What's happened with happy birthday?
We've had a very big ruling this week.
It is quite big.
On the happy birthday case. So this is a dispute between Warner Chappell, the publishing division of Warner Music, who... as far as they're concerned, own the copyright in the classic, legendary song every single person in the world at some point has sung, Happy Birthday.
Which you won't sing because it is still in copyright in Europe.
As we understand it, although that's a little bit complicated, perhaps we'll have time to come to that. I suspect we won't.
That's why I mentioned it now.
But a film company who actually, as far as I can see, have made a film about the history of the song. It's quite an interesting story behind this song. It was two sisters who wrote it in the latter part of the 19th century, the Hill Sisters, and they've made a documentary about it. And in making that documentary, Warner said to them, well, you need to license the use of the song Happy Birthday offers because we own the copyright. Having done a lot of research around the song, they said, we don't think you do own the copyright. We think that the song, certainly within the US, is public domain, which means that the copyright has expired because copyright always eventually runs out. And so they sued Warner Chappell on this point about 2 years ago. There's been a lot of legal wranglings ever since. There were various arguments thrown up. It's been quite a hard case to follow because at every twist and turn, it seemed that the arguments were changing slightly.
Well, in fact, the ruling is that we've got this week is sort of based on a technicality that hasn't really come up before.
I assume it had if we'd been following absolute close.
But it's not been
scrutiny.
One of the main arguments that we've been following through all our reports.
So what we had this week was a summary judgment. So both sides, both Warner and the film company, had presented all of their arguments. There were three key arguments, which I will run through in a second. And then both sides asked for summary judgment. So that's where in the US legal system, you say, we think we've got such a clear case that this doesn't need a proper trial. We don't need to go to court and everyone sort of present. You know, the judge can just read through the arguments and reach a judgment before going through with the full case. And so that's what we had this week. Now, actually, on two of the three arguments, the judge refused summary judgment for either side. He said, no, this is too complicated. It would need a full court hearing to ascertain all of this. But on what actually, you say, was one element that we hadn't been particularly aware of before, but arguably is the most important element of the entire case, he ruled in the film company's favour and against Warner Chappell. So shall I quickly run through the three arguments?
Yes, go quickly.
So the first argument was, so Happy Birthday was written by these two sisters. Originally, they wrote it as Good Morning to You, which you may already know. So it was the same melody, but the lyrics were Good Morning to You, Good Morning to You, Good Morning to You, rather than Happy Birthday. And where the actual Happy Birthday lyrics came from is slightly mysterious.
It may or may not have been one of these sisters.
Exactly. So they definitely wrote it with the Good Morning to You lyrics. And at some point, probably in the early 20th century, people started performing it with the Happy Birthday lyrics instead. Nobody seemed to claim ownership of those lyrics until a court case in the 1930s, when one of the Hill sisters was still alive. And it was at that court case where she said, oh yeah, I wrote those lyrics. Those are mine. But at no point prior to that, by that point, Happy Birthday with the Happy Birthday lyrics had been in various songbooks that had been published, and it never actually credited who the lyrics belonged to. So the film company, as one of their arguments was, we're not convinced that this Hill sister even wrote the lyrics to Happy Birthday. So that was one where the judge said, oh, there's lots of arguments on both sides there. We'd need to have a proper court hearing. Argument number two was, even if she did write the lyrics, we think that she abandoned the copyright. Now, this involves technicalities of early 20th century US copyright law, which you'll be pleased to hear we're not going to talk about. Okay, but based on their interpretation of the copyright law as it was in the early part of the 20th century, they thought that even if the lyrics had been written by the Hill sister and therefore she had the original claim to the copyright, that for various processes, the copyright had been given up. Again, the judge said, that's very complicated, quite a complicated argument. There were good arguments on both sides. This would need to go to full court case. The third argument, which is the one that we've alluded to at several points already today, is even if the Hill sister wrote the lyrics, even if she never abandoned the copyright, we don't think that the copyright in the Happy Birthday lyrics were ever assigned to the American publisher, which Warner Chappell bought in the 1980s, and through that deal it got the Happy Birthday copyright. It's important here, I suppose, to make a distinction between the copyright in the melody of Happy Birthday and the copyright in the lyrics of Happy Birthday, because actually in the end, this case was totally centred on the lyrics. The reason for that is that under US copyright law, both the film company and Warner Chappell agreed that the melody is out of copyright. So whereas over here in Europe, copyright lasts for the life of the creator and then another 70 years, and indeed it does now in America. But 100 years ago, that wasn't how it worked in America. And when they changed the system subsequently, they didn't apply the new rule retrospectively. So under the copyright rules that existed in the early 20th century, the melody has definitely come out of copyright. But what Warner Chappell was saying is, but the original lyrics, Good Morning to You, may also have come out of copyright, but the Happy Birthday lyrics came later. And so therefore, they weren't properly registered with the Copyright Office in the US until the 1930s. And therefore, under the law that applied at that time, we get a copyright term that means that in the US, we have the copyright in the lyrics until 2030. As I say, this final argument was, well, even if somebody has the copyright in the lyrics until 2030, that's also a debate, but even if somebody does, it ain't you. Yeah. Because while there is evidence that the Hill sisters assigned the copyright of Good Morning to You, okay, so both the lyrics and the original melody to this American publishing company way back, also, subsequent reinterpretations of the melody were registered in the 1930s. And obviously, if you rewrite a bit of music, if you do a different arrangement, it creates a new copyright. So they were assigned to this publisher, and that is Warner Chappell definitely own those. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence about the actual Happy Birthday lyrics. And this is where the summary judgment went against Warner Chappell. The judge has said, yeah, no assignment ever took place. So the one thing we can be certain about, says the judge, is that whatever the copyright status of Happy Birthday in the US and beyond, you, Warner Chappell, do not control the lyrics.
And that's quite problematic for Warner Chappell because it has been collecting royalties on those lyrics since 1988.
Yes.
And it's even more problematic, aside from the fact that it means that Warner now can't potentially... it will appeal, I should point out, so this isn't over. But assuming this ruling stands for all time, Warner now can't collect money on that until 2030, and the film company reckons that Warner collects about $2 million a year on it. So that's a chunk of change. But also, this became a class action at some point, which means that potentially Warner would have to refund everyone it's ever collected royalties from on those lyrics. And that's a bigger chunk of change.
Now, this part of the case is still to be considered in court. What about the damages in terms of refunding, A, the specific plaintiffs, the people who actually pursued the litigation, who themselves have licensed the song in the past. And as you say, because it became a class action, in theory, anybody who had licensed it, again, that would be a slight jurisdiction point. Certainly that would apply in the US. But whether it would apply beyond, well, that's another matter. I don't quite know the answer to that question. But yes, if this ruling stands, as you say, almost certainly Warner will appeal. But if it stands after appeal, then you could have a long line of people lining up and saying, hang on a second, we gave you, you know, 50 quid, 500 quid. Who knows? If it was synced into a film, it may have been thousands of pounds, yeah, or tens of thousands of pounds even. So it may well be that a lot of people come forward trying to get their money back. So it will be interesting to see how Warner respond to all of this. I suppose it will also be in terms of public performance, because if you sing Happy Birthday in a restaurant, then while Warner Chappell, in theory, owns the copyright, then money is paid, albeit through the collective licensing system. Money goes up through PRS, which goes to Warner Chappell. So God knows how much money over the years PRS and in the US, BMI and ASCAP have collected for that song, which in theory, I suppose that should go back to, I mean, how the hell you'd ever work out how to redistribute any of that money, I've no idea. But it would create an admin nightmare.
It would. Well, as I think we did mention last time, TGI Fridays has its own happy birthday song to get around the problem of having to pay royalties. Presumably TGI Fridays owns the copyright on its own birthday song.
But if this stands, then there you go. There's the ultimate summary of this story. Very soon, perhaps even in TGI Fridays, they will be singing the proper happy birthday song rather than the silly version that they created to avoid having to pay any money to PRS and whoever. So, but it's a big ruling. It's another big copyright ruling. We've had, we had the Blurred Lines ruling earlier this year on a totally different topic. But we seem to be having some big landmark rulings in the US courts on copyright issues. And it will be fascinating to see now how Warner respond to this. And if the ruling does stand, what kind of damages we're looking at and how the hell those will be applied for and paid back.
The official charts company announced this week that it is going to start including the sales of records at gigs in chart stats. So if you buy a CD or a bit of vinyl, when you go and see whoever, One Direction is the only band I can think of, but that's not the best example at this point, it will count towards their chart position.
Do you think all the One Direction fans at the Apple Music Festival were all lining up at the merch stall to buy the album on CD? Is that what you're picturing
in
your head?
I'm sure, yeah.
So this is another change to the way that the official charts are compiled by the UK record industry. It's specifically the albums chart, although that may well be because they don't think people are buying certainly CD singles at merch stalls. I don't even know about vinyl singles. So what it means is that artists who have their recorded content available on the merch stall at their gigs and who are selling it that way previously, although that's a really good way to sell music, and it's become an increasingly important way to sell music, particularly if you've got one of those fan bases who just won't buy your CDs or pay for your downloads, but actually you sell out decent-sized venues. And so as an artist and as a manager of an artist, one clever ruse has been, OK, well, we'll make sure we have the CDs or maybe a special version of the CD on the stall at the gig. So when everyone's on a high and they're a little bit drunk.
Not at One Direction gigs.
Not at One Direction gigs. They'll be high on, pop. But you grab them on the way out and they buy the CD. And that's great. It's a new way of generating revenue. I'll say it's not new. Obviously, artists have done this always. But it's increasingly important.
As sales in shops dwindle, yes, this does become a more important way of buying records. And to a certain extent, I think, it's always been a way for bands to kind of make money, or like bands on a lower level to make money to buy petrol to get to the next gig. And there's sort of, I think, certainly sometimes when I go to gigs, I'll buy the record at the show so that I know that that money, or at least more of that money, goes straight to the band. And now, you could help boost their chart position as well. So that's quite a nice little, additional bonus.
And I suppose, for artists who have been seeing an increasing number of the records they sell happening at the merch stall at gigs, that has been one of the bugbears. That is, well, OK, we're making the money and that's great, but it's irritating that if that person, the same person that bought the same record but down at HMV down the road, that would then be a tick in the album charts. And I think managers in particular have been calling for this for a long time. And I think labels, now that labels are seeing this as a more sort of, it's not just for very small bands trying to raise a little bit of petrol money. It is actually now something that bands on the next level up are starting to use as a way of generating more revenue around their records. So labels have started to call for it as well.
Yeah. And I think probably, the official charts company will probably tell you that the reason they've not done this before largely is because this is obviously quite an easy system to game. It would be quite easy to just say, oh yeah, we sold 20 million records at that gig in the pub around the corner.
I don't know once you reach a certain level of venue, but certainly at more grassroots venues, it is usually one of the artist's team and often manager or tour manager who actually run the stall. So whereas you're a retailer, there's always a middleman who in theory is impartial. Yes, it's the one way, I suppose. The direct-to-fan is the same, except that you are normally using a direct-to-fan digital platform that in itself it has as a third man.
Yeah, so they've built this system called Lightning Live, which is apparently a very secure way to report this sales data. It's all on a secure online system. You have to state in advance your inventory before you open the merch stand at the gig. Then you have to report how many sales you had. And then there's a research company called Millard Brown who will check it, who will check it against kind of expected sales trends.
The other thing you'll
have
to...
If it looks dodgy, you're out.
You'll have to say how many people, how many tickets you sold.
Yes.
So you can't say, oh, well, we brought 10,000 copies to the gig. Oh, it's a 50-capacity venue. So again, they're looking for ways so that both the official charts company team themselves and this research firm that they use can keep an eye on the stats and say, does that look right? Does that not look right? I mean, I can't imagine. I mean, unlike adding streaming data, and actually even when they add streaming data, it never has the massive impact on the chart that I think some people think it will. And I can't help thinking that this will have an almost non-existent effect on the actual order in which things come up on the charts. Having said that...
Well, I think probably streaming data has... It's an effect that it has probably more on the lower end of the chart. Though I think that, you know, there are things that have been the top end of the chart. I can't think of any examples now that have been affected by, you know, high streams.
Well, we talked to me about how Ed Sheeran stayed in the charts for such a long time, and that was almost certainly because the people keep streaming in a way that they don't keep buying.
Yeah, and if a band, a band's going to go on a world tour for 2 years, but, you know, they're not going to be touring the UK for so long that it would have that long effect. But I think, you know, if you're on a week-long, two-week-long arena tour of the UK, you probably are shifting a decent number of CDs at those shows, and it might have some effect on your chart position.
So I guess we will see. Very much welcomed by the label and artist community, although most managers I know were like, yeah, bloody time, because they've done this in America for a very long time now. But systems in place, they've piloted it, and so as of later this autumn, your album chart will be complete with merch stall CD vinyl sales. Okay, time now to recap on what has been CMU approved this week. Just in case you forgot, we're on a tight deadline this week. So Andy Malt is going to tell you in record time why he approved the various people that he approved this week. Although we begin, as I think we did last week.
We did.
With a Vigsy recommend.
Yes, Paul Vig picked Benjamin Damage on Monday for his new album Obsidian. He picked a track called Trickster. It's interesting because it's the very last LP release on the 50 Weapons label, which is shutting up shop in December after it releases its 50th single, which was always its aim.
Although this is an album.
This is an album. Its album releases don't count towards its 50 Weapons.
So that's approved number one. Approved number two this week is Fort Lean.
Fort Lean, who caught my attention this week with a very odd video. It started off...
It caught my attention with your very odd write-up of the very odd video.
Well, it needed to be discussed properly.
When are you doing that?
the track's called Cut to the Chase. It's from a new EP called New Hobbies, which has just come out. And the video it starts off like it's quite... a cute idea, like it's a couple in a karaoke booth and they start singing one of the band's songs and then it kicks in and you're like, oh, that's nice. And then it just goes weird. It goes really, really weird. And very little of the song is actually in the video. But enough to go, that is a song I would like to hear in full. I will go to Spotify and check it out, which I did.
From strange videos to strange names... Ringo Death Star.
Ringo Death Star, who, that's a name, isn't it? They're releasing their fifth album called Pure Mood in November. They've just released a single called Guilt. This is what I approved. It's, I would say, about as high energy as shoegaze gets. And it's got some really great bass riffs in it that I urge you to listen to.
The reason we're on a very tight deadline with this podcast is because we're recording it on Wednesday instead of Thursday, so we're stealing somebody else's slot in the studio. It also means that I know nothing about the next approved because you haven't written it yet, because the daily's not out. But tell us what your final approved is going to be.
But magically, I have chosen it. It is Yulipe, who is a Japanese producer. She's just released a new album called Lease. I picked the title track from it. It's quite, it's kind of a mix. I would say mainly quite hard industrial electronic production with some lighter moments to so you don't get bogged down in it. This album is credited to Ulipe in France for some reason. I haven't quite worked out why that is. Maybe I will by Thursday and people will be able to go and check my write-up.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved is where you will find that write-up.
Yes.
And links and videos and all the other stuff you need to be listening to the approved tracks this week.
Okay, here's something we probably didn't expect to ever say. Deezer is going to be the first European streaming service to float itself on the stock market.
Except, of course, if you had been writing the CMU Daily in August, which you weren't this year, but if you had been, we did sort of know this was coming.
Yeah, no, I know we did, but, that wouldn't have been quite the bold introduction.
It wouldn't have been
a
dramatic introduction.
And you've now completely undermined.
But Bloomberg reported on rumours at the time that Deezer was busy trying to raise more money to try and further its growth in terms of users. Obviously, has a big competitor in Spotify, which in terms of users is quite a bit ahead of Deezer now. Plus, Apple are now in the market and putting a big marketing spend. So Deezer needs to raise more money. And at the time, they said that while they may go the traditional route that the streaming startups have done, which is to go to, you know, venture capitalists and rich people and raise money that way, that an initial public offering, so floating the company or some of the company, raising money for a stock exchange, was on the agenda. And that's what has been confirmed this week, that it is very much on the agenda and will likely happen this side of Christmas. And I suppose what is interesting is in terms of, I mean, we expect a lot of the streaming startups to float. I mean,
we've been expecting Spotify to do
exactly.
It for several years now.
I mean, these streaming music companies, when one or two things will happen, they'll either get bought in a massive deal by, like, well, it's usually Yahoo who buys them, isn't it, and then utterly screws them up, or they float on a stock exchange. And there's been rampant speculation about Spotify's IPO. They keep saying, oh, no. Oh, you look, you've hired somebody that's clearly investor relations for your forthcoming IPO. But Spotify raised a load more cash through the conventional means relatively recently. So we're not looking at Spotify IPO to at least the end of next year now. And what we didn't expect until last month was Deezer would sneak in ahead of them and try and raise money for a stock exchange before.
Yeah, so as you say, probably by the end of this year, it will float on the Paris Stock Exchange Euronext. And this isn't, obviously, I don't know if we talked on the podcast before. We probably have at some point because it's been such a long-running story. But Spotify has an $8.5 billion valuation
now,
which is
insane,
just
like that.
Ridiculous.
For a company that hasn't yet made a profit, however great it may be.
Deezer's valuation is more around $1 billion, which is still quite stupid. But we're expecting Spotify to IPO in order to, you know, pay off its initial investors, for everyone to have a big payday.
Yes, because I suppose the founders and then all of those early investors who put money in, the ones who put money in earlier this year, when you invest in that kind of company, which is not currently profitable and realistically is not going to be profitable, I mean, Deezer reckon now 2018, were they saying, that they might go month on month profitable, not profitable overall, month on month. When you put money into one of these companies, it's not that you think, oh, well, in 2 years' time, they'll suddenly start making millions in profits and I'll get 10% of those profits. You put the money in thinking, at some point, this will grow, it'll hype, and then they'll float and it'll be worth $8.5 billion, and that's when I'll make my money. Because my 1% of the company will be worth a lot of money when it floats and I can go and sell it on a stock exchange and get my money back then. So often for tech startups, the initial investors, that's their business plan, is it doesn't matter whether or not this company ever makes a profit, I will profit on flotation. But this, we know, is less about those early investors, of which there are less in Deezer.
Yes.
And includes people like Orange, the telco. It's less about them being able to cash in. And indeed, we've been told that they won't even sell their shares at the point of flotation. It is to raise more cash to market and grow and to further the development.
Yes, because as you said, it's an increasingly difficult market for certainly the smaller, well, everyone in streaming is having a slightly tough time. But when you're up against Spotify and now Apple, that puts Deezer in a significantly more difficult place, and it needs money to expand and to diversify and to sustain itself into the future.
And I mean, Deezer is a similar age. In fact, I think Deezer went live slightly before Spotify.
Yeah.
So it's not
that
Deezer...
They used to talk that up quite a lot.
Yeah. It's not that Deezer is a newcomer. Obviously, they initially launched in France. They have a very strong partnership with Orange in France because Orange is a shareholder. So a lot of Deezer people, actually, they have it bundled in with their Orange subscription. So they're a big player in France. It took a while to grow, but then boy did they grow in terms of countries. They're now in a stupid number of countries around
yes.
the world.
It's bizarrely the streaming service that is in the most countries, but is in terms of users who are, you know, actually using the service, it's considerably smaller than Spotify.
And now also, I suppose we're waiting to see Apple Music subscriptions because they don't have a freemium element, which Deezer does. And also, although Deezer's figures are, they're in their millions in terms of paying, I think, was it 5 million was the middle? That's quite an old figure now. They've not declared in a while. Mm. But we think that a lot of Deezer's users, and certainly the labels who see the money coming in, a lot of Deezer's users are still based in France. So although they're in all of these countries around the world, they have users internationally, but their core base in terms of users and income remains in the French market. And so they want money to help grow. The company that owns Warner Music, Access Industries, is also an investor in Deezer, a relatively recent investor, and I think actually now has quite a sizable stake in the business, as does Warner Music itself, and Universal, and Sony. And I would suspect the indies, although I'm not entirely sure about the Merlin deal with Deezer, but the record companies have equity in Deezer in the same way they do with Spotify and most of the streaming startups. If you start up a streaming company, it's a condition to get a license that you give the record companies a bit of equity. And that has been controversial in the artist community.
I think that might be the most interesting thing about this IPO and might be a little kind of
test
of how Spotify will fare in this.
Now, of course, it may well be that the labels don't sell their equity when this floats, so it might not happen later this year. But if they did, artists are saying, well, hang on a second, when you cash in your equity and make a load of money, where's our cut of that money? And we expect the labels to say, and Sony Music have been the ones to be most overt in this because they're actually, it's subject to a part of a litigation that they've got. And it's been brought up as part of a lawsuit with a company saying, we should get a cut of that equity. And Sony saying, no. On an artist contract, the contract clearly states that we only share the revenue if the revenue is specifically generated by the artist's tracks. And the 5% stake that we have in Spotify, that's nothing to do with any specific tracks being exploited. So under a classic artist contract, and I think most lawyers would agree that actually that is a correct interpretation of a classic artist contract. So under contract, the labels probably aren't obliged to share the music with their artists. But there are plenty of artists and certainly managers who are saying, well, whatever the strict interpretation of the contract might say, that's clearly not fair. Because if you didn't have our recordings, you could never have demanded the equity, which with the Spotify flotation could be worth a considerable sum of money. So we expect there to be a big row when the first big transaction takes place, because at the moment, most of this rowing is about money that doesn't exist yet. The Spotify IPO will be where potentially a huge sum of money will be on the table. But, you know, the Deezer one will also, certainly it will give that equity a valuation, because at the moment it's all a bit made up. I think they reckon the labels have got about 20% between them and will be able to say, well, that is now worth X based on the share price. And I think that will fuel that debate even further.
So, a story to continue watching. Okay, just time to run through some of the stories we literally do not have time to talk about this week. The RIAA has announced its figures for the first half of 2015 and notes an upswing in revenues. Yes, that's right, an upswing of 0.8%. That is our stat of the week, and the jingle will go in here.
There isn't time for the jingle this week, so Matt had a good excuse.
Kim.com's extradition hearing has begun in New Zealand, but we promised not to talk about that, so we won't. A new streaming service has hit the news lately. It's about to launch, called Oros. It is in the news because it's fueled by BitTorrent, which is a ropey way of doing things. It launched a crowdfunding campaign, which it has pulled after it got what it's called unwanted attention.
Which might have been me pointing out that if you did fund this app, because it's a piracy service, you could be liable for copyright infringement. So who knows?
Chris Cook claiming to have done that there. Viet Cong are going to change their name with their second album. And Morrissey is quitting touring in the UK. There's no more time to talk about those. Let's just talk about Ryan Adams.
Ryan Adams covering Taylor Swift. Although that's not this week's news. That we've known that for a while, that Ryan Adams was bringing out not just one Taylor Swift cover track.
A full album.
An entire cover version of the 1989 album. And it came out last week?
It came out this week.
This week,
okay. It might have been last week. Oh, no, it's new music comes out on Fridays now, doesn't it? I don't know. I listened to it this week, so let's just say it came out this week.
There's been a lot of chatter about this, mainly because Taylor Swift keeps giving... I mean, Taylor Swift seems to have given more interviews about this than Ryan Adams has, because she keeps saying, oh, I'm a big Ryan Adams fan, this is really exciting.
Who wants to talk to Ryan Adams? if you were given the option of talking to Taylor Swift or Ryan Adams, you would probably take Taylor Swift.
So that's out. If you're a Ryan Adams fan or a Taylor Swift fan, or just the concept of Ryan Adams covering a whole Taylor Swift album amuses you, then you can go and listen to that. But that's not actually what we're here to talk about.
It's sort of, it's an interesting thing. I think it's worth noting the slight irony of the album being available on Spotify and YouTube.
Yes.
I found that quite amusing.
Given Taylor is not a fan of freemium platforms but also, for her recordings, but clearly doesn't care for her songs.
Clearly. So she'll finally make a bit of money off Spotify again, and less off YouTube, because that's the way of the world. Anyway, Ryan Adams, if you've listened to this album, which I'm sure you have, recorded these songs sort of in the style of Bruce Springsteen.
Now, has he stated that, or is that just what the outcome is?
I believe he has stated that. And if he hasn't stated that, then he should do, because they really are. And so Father John Misty, former member of the Fleet Foxes, did a little joke. He recorded, I think, Welcome to New York and Blank Space in the style of the Velvet Underground.
So if you follow that now, he's covered in a style, Ryan Adams' cover, in a style of Taylor Swift.
Yes.
And a diagram.
So he tweeted about him recording these covers of songs from Ryan Adams' classic album, 1989. But
much hilarity ensued.
Much hilarity.
But not for very long.
Not for very long. A day later, those songs have been deleted from SoundCloud. And not because of any kind of Taylor Swift-style moral outrage over freemium streaming services.
Or Ryan Adams.
Or Ryan Adams.
At his cover of a cover being covered.
No, it was the outrage of Lou Reed. Now, Lou Reed, you might remember, is quite dead.
Yeah, he's definitely dead.
He is very dead.
So how does Lou Reed have an opinion? I mean, I take it that obviously Ryan Adams, not Ryan Adams,
Father John Misty.
Father John Misty has taken the liberty of stealing the style of his former band for his little bit of this silly project. So I understand why Lou Reed might have had an opinion while alive, but how does he have an opinion now he's dead?
Well, he came to Father John Misty in a dream.
Oh, well, of course.
And he said to him, delete those tracks, don't summon the dead, I'm not your plaything. And those are pretty firm words. So he... Father John Misty, not Lou Reed. He was still in the dream. Father John Misty got up out of bed and he deleted those tracks, because when Lou Reed, dead or otherwise, tells you to do something, you bloody well do it.
He described all of this in a post, although if you find the post, he describes the entire dream.
It's a very long dream and he describes it in one paragraph.
And he describes it in incredible detail. So either he is unique in having a really good memory of every single dream that he does, or there is a little bit of manufacturing going on here.
I suspect, yes, that might be the case.
Because it's quite a long story. The Lou Reed bit is quite late in the story.
It's funnier if you take it at face value.
So those tracks are no longer available. I don't know if anyone has leaked them anywhere.
I think they are available on YouTube.
On YouTube.
Speaking of which, I think that Ryan Adams could be onto a thing here. Lou Reed hasn't told him to take down anything. So Ryan Adams still got his 1989 album.
Yeah, unless Bruce
right
appears in the dream tonight.
I think Ryan Adams should start doing... That should just be his thing now. Recording streaming holdouts albums in the style of other artists.
So who are the streaming holdouts?
Well, I would quite like to hear him next do Tool in the style of Leonard Cohen. I think that could work quite well. So if Ryan, if you're listening, which I'm sure you are, that's next on
the
list.
That's your assignment. And then who knows who would cut? No, I can't even get my head around who would cover the cover of the cover.
Maybe that should be it. You, now, all releases should be some iteration of a cover of a cover of a cover of a Taylor Swift song.
That would overcome all the songwriters who say, on the royalties we currently earn from the streaming services, we can't afford.
The only songs now that anyone can record are on the Taylor Swift's 1989 album. Those are the only songs that exist from this point onwards.
Yeah, so songwriters who are saying they can
Which does mean that my Tool album is off the cards.
Well, perhaps
there's a small price to pay.
A footnote. My point was, all the songwriters who keep moaning that they can't afford to live in this streaming age, they're no longer required. Because on your system, all the songs we ever need are written.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I think my system works.
And if you're not impressed with that system, well, turns out in America, Happy Birthday is not in copyright anymore. So sing that all you like.
For money.
The tiny little allotted time space that we managed to steal on this early record of the podcast is over. I don't know whether you're willing to steal another 22 seconds to do the bit at the end.
Yeah,
or
why not?
We just repeat last week's, because it's the same every week.
No one's quite banging down the door yet, although I've seen someone outside the window. Anyway, sounds like... You make it sound like we've snuck into the studio.
Well, we like, pretty much have.
Well, yeah. Okay, well, we better finish up then. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this podcast, please do tweet us at CMU or leave us a message on our Facebook page, Complete Music Update. Let us know what you thought of the show, or if you just think it's better if we do it in half an hour really quickly.
Or if you don't think that, then you're more at liberty to rewind and listen to it again.
Yes.
Because I think it'll be better on second listen.
You should also, you know, if you want to... No, not if you want to. You should absolutely rate and review it on iTunes. Set up an iTunes account if you don't have one. I know some people don't.
Chris, Andy and Matt.
That's us.
That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bye.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7Digital.
The company that owns Warner Music, Access Industries.
Oh.
We're going to say that again.
Access Industries.